Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the broader field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. Anand Taneja's Genealogy, Time, Islam, and Ecological Thought in the Medieval Ruins of Delhi is a landmark publication that interrogates modes of religious practice and imaginaries of time that disrupt dominant claims and narratives of the post-colonial state about religion and religious identity. Centered on the ruins of Firoz Shah Kotla in Delhi, this book brings into view visions of sovereignty, ethics, hospitality, and intercommunal encounters that rescue Islam in modern South Asia from the suffocating pressures, anxieties, and amnesias of nationalist politics and historiographies. Conceptually bold, ethnographically vivacious, and historically grounded, this book masterfully carries a tragic sensibility while also offering provocative avenues of hope and optimism. Written with poetic eloquence and lyrical command, this book will not only be widely read and debated by scholars of South Asia, Islam, and religion, it also cries out for adoption as what will surely become a Bollywood blockbuster. Here now is my conversation with Professor Anand Taneja. Hello, Anand. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Sher Ali?
Very good, Anand. Thank you so much for your time and for this wonderful book that I'm sure will spark some excellent conversations in multiple fields. Great talking to you today. Anand, you might know that we have a tradition on the New Books Network that our first question is always biographical. Could you share with our listeners a bit, Anand, about how you became a scholar of Islam, of South Asia, an anthropologist, and how you got to write this particular book?
Okay, thanks very much for that question. I mean, my becoming an anthropologist and a scholar of Islam in South Asia is actually a very locational answer. It's based on my having spent several years in Delhi. So I moved to Delhi when I was 18 years old as a college student, and I was always interested in history. So I became a student of history. That was my major in college as an undergraduate. And what was interesting about being a history student of history in Delhi is that it's a city that is just covered with ruins, right? It's covered with ruins and monuments from the pre-modern period, right? And a lot of these are monuments that are mosques and tombs, etc., built by the Muslim rulers of Delhi between the 13th and 18th centuries. So, and, you know, fortifications and stuff. So I became really interested in visiting all of these remains of the past as a student of history. And as I spent time among these, I actually worked as a tour, as someone who gave guided tours, like a docent of these ruins as well. But as I was spending time in them, I became really interested in the kind of life that people lived around these ruins as well. And then my master, and then I actually went on to do a master's degree in filmmaking at Jamia Millia Islamia, which is a program which really emphasizes documentary filmmaking. So that's the time when I actually kind of started moving closer towards what we could call an ethnographic sensibility, because I was talking to people and trying to elicit their stories. And I made a film, a student film, about another building in Delhi called the Purana Kila, the old fort. So I was trying to look at the 20th century histories of something that was built in the 16th century. So I became interested in all of these ways in which people live with these monuments. Now, the thing is that many of the historical monuments of Delhi are very Islamic, right? In the sense that they are often mosques, they're often dargahs or the shrines of Sufi saints. So if you're interested in the history of Delhi and you're interested in lived life around these buildings, you can't but become interested in Islam. So that's what I mean by saying that my kind of beginning as an anthropologist or scholar of Islam in South Asia is a very situated and local beginning.
Terrific. So perhaps, Anand, we can begin by you having our explain to our listeners a bit the key site which anchors your study, which is the Firoz Shah Kotla and its ruins. Could you tell us about what Firoz Shah Kotla is, where it's located, its history, and its present? And then if I could ask you also to touch on what I saw as one of the central conceptual arguments and interventions of this book, which is to really disrupt dominant claims and narratives of the post-colonial state about religion and religious identity that you advance by looking at the site. So perhaps two-part question, one more of a descriptive and second more of a conceptual intervention related.
Sure. Firoz Shah Kotla is a 14th century ruin. It was built in approximately the 1350s. And it's now in a relatively tumble-down state, but it was a massive fortified palace complex, which was the site for the capital of Firoz Shah Tughlaq of the Tughlaq dynasty. It's been in a ruined condition for a long time, but in contemporary Delhi, it's at a very interesting location because it's located just to the south of the old walled city of Shah Jahanabad, which was built by the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan in the mid 17th century. And it's kind of at the junction of that city with the newer Delhi built by the British in the early 20th century. And then, of course, kind of the post-colonial development of Delhi after that, right? So immediately to the south of Firoz Shah Kotla now, not only do you have settlements of Punjabi refugees and also of formalized kind of Dalit colonies, but you also have the center for the newspaper industry, right? Bahadur Shah Zafar Marg. So it's this kind of very interesting junction. It's the ruin at the junction of what's called Old Delhi and New Delhi. So what became interesting, so very simply, the site is a 14th century ruin fortified palace complex. Since the 1970s, since the late 1970s, it has become increasingly prominent in the city as a dargah or saint shrine in which the saints are not, human, but jinn or genies, spirits in Islamic cosmology. Now, this in itself is very unusual. I mean, in all over the Muslim world, you have traditions of intimacy with the jinn, and whether people are terrified of them or whether they have relations with them. People have various kinds of relations with the jinn historically. I don't know any other place where the jinn are given the status of saints. So I became really interested in why this was happening in contemporary Delhi and in what ways it might be connected to the politics of the city, to the history of the city, to the ecology of the city, and to the ways in which different groups interact with each other in the city. Because what is interesting about this site, as it is about many other places identified as dargahs or Muslim saint shrines in the subcontinent, is that it is a space of an extraordinary amount of diversity in terms of the people who come here. So the people who come here include Muslims, of course, but also many, many Hindus, more women than men. And if you look at the caste profile of those we would identify as Hindus who come here, it is the proportion of Dalits or former untouchables is very high. So one of the there are two major things that I do in the book in terms of your question about disrupting the dominant claims and narratives of the post-colonial state and about religion and religious identity. So I make one argument in the book that that there is the post-colonial state claims or tends to forget all of the things that happened before the foundation of the state in 1947. And because jinn, and I make the claim, and I think that one of the reasons that jinn become saintly or have this elevated status in post-partition, post-colonial Delhi is because they are figures. Their jinns are much longer lived than humans in Islamic cosmology, because they become, so I make the argument that they become figures of memory, figures who remember things that are supposed to be long forgotten. And that is why they have a renewed importance in the post-colonial present. And the other thing I say in the book, because I wanted to think about, and I kind of contribute to an ongoing set of ethnographic and you know, religious studies, anthropological and religious studies literature about why is it, what is it about sites like dargahs, which are sites of mixed congregation, and I make a point, kind of moving away from you know, ideas like syncretism or ideas that what we see here is kind of particularly Indic, to make the claim that what we see at sites like this is that that the reason that people come here is not, and both Hindus and Muslims, is that is not because of Islam as restricted as a religious identity, but that Islam serves as an ethical inheritance that everyone who comes here can claim and use towards, you know, towards changing their lives in certain ways, or to use the language I use in the book, for a certain kind of ethical self-fashioning. So,
terrific. So the title of the book is Jinnology. So Anand, could you perhaps explain to our listeners a bit what this means, this concept, this idea of jinnology, perhaps with an example? And one of the central thematics of this concept, and something you've already touched on in your last answer, mm-hmm. is that the idea of jinnology relies on a certain notion of temporality, a certain notion of temporality that again counters the post-colonial states, what you call historical amnesia. So I was wondering if you could also fold this concept into your response, this idea of historical amnesia, as you call it, and how that relates to this idea of jinnology and what that is as it operates in your book.
Okay, so let me start by again giving a very situated location answer, located in place and in materials. So I, the hardest part of my work, the research for this book, was actually getting access to archival records, especially the records of the archaeological survey, which I wanted to access because the Firoz Shah Kotla is a protected monument right now. It is under the control of the Archaeological Survey of India, or the ASI, which is currently under the Ministry of Tourism and Culture. So there were two things that were interesting to me. One, it was very hard to get into the archives. Now, this is an experience that many researchers have in South Asia and something we take for granted. And I hadn't really thought about why it was difficult till I started seeing what happened when you got into the archives. What was the nature of the documents you could see when you were in the archives? And what was really interesting for me to see in looking at the actual content of files in the archive was the ways in which they had forgotten or wished to forget everything that happened before 1947. So to give you a very, to give an example that I talk about in the book, there is a tomb called Sultan Ghari in South Delhi. It is the tomb of the son of Sultan Iltutmish, the second Sultan of the Mamluk or slave dynasty in Delhi. It is one of the oldest, it is perhaps the oldest tomb within the current, Muslim tomb within the current boundaries of India. We have an account of this being a venerated saint shrine going back to at least the 18th century. In 1947, the Journal of the Archaeological Survey of India published another article which says that there is, you know, that there is every year in the month of Zikad, you have pilgrims coming in. Fine, so that's the record from 1947. In 1955, there's already been violence, so the place has been abandoned because of partition violence. And the Jamiat Ulama-e-Hind, an organization of religious scholars in Delhi, writes to the archaeological survey and says, listen, the grave here at Sultan Ghari has been damaged because of the riots. We would urge you to repair it, and we want to kind of revive the Urs. and so please give us permission. So the archaeological survey repairs the grave, but then they write back saying, we, as far as we know, there has been no worship here for a very long time, so we can't give you permission to revive religious practice. Now, that is, if you, again, so I'm looking at this, I'm going, very long time, but you have a published record in the Journal of the Archaeological Survey of India saying that there was worship here in 1947. I mean, so what sense of time is it in which 8 years becomes a very long time? So that I became interested in the ways in which that's just one example, but you kind of encounter this again and again. The deliberate absence of, it's very hard to access post-colonial archives. And when you get access into the post-colonial archives, you discover that there's a silence about, and I think it's particularly telling when the silence is about historical buildings, right? These are supposed to be places of memory. And again and again, you have this thing that, you know, things have not been used here for a very long time. There is a kind of structured silence. In which documents are hard to get at, and once you get into the documents, there is this kind of creation of a silence around everything that happens before the foundation of the state. And I think that is what I call archival amnesia, right? That there is a way in which the state wishes to forget what is inside the archive rather than what is left out of it. I became interested in that and the kind of vision of temporality that comes with it, that everything that happens before 1947 is a very long time ago. So we are going to forget all kinds of histories and claims on the state that existed before 1947. And part of the reason, of course, is because of the enormous violence that happened with the partition of the subcontinent and the ways in which, you know, that kind of haunted the state, right? And the possibility of that violence coming back. And to contrast this archival amnesia that I was discovering while I was nosing around in the archives, there was the stories that were being told about jinn at Firoz Shah Kotla and in other places of Delhi, right, in the published literature, where the jinn become these figures of extremely long memory, of remembering things hundreds and thousands of years ago, right? So there are stories I explore in the book. So stories told at Firoz Shah Kotla, for example, where the jinn allow Shah Waliullah of Delhi, the famous 18th century theologian, they become a jinn who was alive at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, becomes a link who directly connects the Prophet to Shah Waliullah. And another story in which the jinn, one particular jinn, becomes the mode of connection through, he becomes the chain, he becomes the link in the chain who connects Moses to Jesus to the Prophet Muhammad. Now, these stories tell you about the ways in which the jinn serve as modes of connection, connecting human beings centuries apart in time, and serving as witnesses to times that are long gone, right, to which you have no other memory. This is what I call genealogy. And I found it that it was very interesting that these are the stories about jinn that have been told in Delhi, this idea of this long-lived, more than human memory, at a time when the post-colonial state is actually invested in archival amnesia and forgetting the ways in which there was a Muslim presence and a Muslim landscape in Delhi till 1947, right? So what is very proximate is being erased, and that's at the same time in which you have the emergence of the jinn as figures of memory.
Terrific. So let's continue with this thread, Anand, this idea of interrupting linear conceptions of temporality. Perhaps could you share with our listeners a bit about the ritual practices that populate Firoz Shah Kotla? I mean, when people go there, what do they do? What kinds of ritual practices does one find there? And here I'm, of course, referring to a chapter in which you talk about rituals, but also saintly visions and Hindi cinema very fruitfully.
Yeah.
But I was wondering if you could perhaps, with the example of some of these ritual practices, share with us a bit more about how they also interrupt these linear conceptions of temporality, which are then amenable to these modern nationalist fixed notions of identity also.
Thank you. So one of the most, one of the things that caught my eye early on at Firoz Shah Kotla, and which I kind of keep returning to in different ways in the book that I learned. So people often write letters of petition, but letters are then you, as I discovered as I was looking around in these rooms, you don't see singular petitions. You often see these petitions photocopied, you know, as if being, and people talk about it as ki yahan pe aake, you know, when the people talk about what they imagine Firoz Shah Kotla to be like, they often have a very bureaucratic imagination of it, right? Like that the jinns have who are saints, who have a government with various departments. And people put in photocopied letters, right? So they're writing their petitions and they photocopy these petitions and put them in. And these petitions often have passport photos attached with them. They almost invariably have people's addresses. And as part of my work here, I've read those petitions very closely. I would take photographs of them, right, while they were in situ. I didn't like disturb them. But I would take these photos and I would read, you know, a small sample of these letters. And then what I saw in these letters was, yes, they seem to be in this form of, you know, modern bureaucratic letters. But if you read the content of the letters and the actual form of the letters, these letters are referring to an older kind of imagination of dealing with the state. These letters are, in effect, shikwas, right, or petitions that are meant to be read by the sovereign. Now, that is something that we know existed in the political theory of the pre-modern sultanate even into Mughal India, because this is normative political theory that, for example, Nizam-ul-Mulk Tusi writes about in his Siyasatnama, right? That for twice in a week, the king should be available to all his subjects to be able to address their complaints to him directly. And if they can't address directly, there should be these letters that they can write and which he is obliged to read. That is not what people's experience of government is, right, in the contemporary period. There's many more mediating layers of bureaucracy that you have to go through. But it was amazing to me to see that, okay, here's this idea of writing this very intimate petition about all the things that are going wrong with you, and you're depositing them in the ruins of a 14th century palace. And in Delhi and in a Tughlaq palace, and we actually have historical evidence from reading Ibn Battuta's, for example, of such letters being deposited in Tughlaq palaces. And that, I think, is really amazing. That, or that was what, you know, in some senses is very, very interesting, that you have a pre-colonial, medieval, let's say, form of or imagination of how you interact with the sovereign, right? By this writing this really intimate shikwa about all the things that are wrong with you and which you hope to be redressed, and you're depositing it in the ruins of a 14th century royal palace, while at the same time using the technologies with which you would approach a 21st century post-colonial state, right? Because not only do you have photocopies, not only do you have passport photos and addresses, sometimes people actually use the forms of identity that you do use to present yourself to the state, right? So people use voter ID cards, for example, so and copies of those. So it was interesting to me that people are living with these multiple temporalities at once. They're living with this idea of the pre-colonial and approaching it, and they're turning to the gems, and they're living in the world of the contemporary state and its photocopying, and they're also spending time in pre-modern built space. And I mean, if you look at Firoz Shah Kotla and the ways in which people inhabit the space, it's very different from the rest of the play, the city that they live in, right? The rest of the city does not look like this anymore. It does not have the same built form. It does not have the same, it's not materially or aesthetically the same at all. But that is part of the reason people come here, right? So it is the ruination of the place and being able to come to a place that feels old and interacting with the city in a different way. That is very much at the center of why I think people come here. And of course, the stories of the jinn and remembering what things were like a long time ago has been kind of central to the narratives of the jinn. And I think it's very important that all of this is happening in a state, in the capital of a state, in a city, in which the pre-colonial past is almost entirely forgotten, or is entirely forgotten in official narratives, right? So we don't really tell a story of Delhi before 1947 in the official account. So in ways that I feel that what is happening at Firoz Shah Kotla is through ritual and the religious imagination is a counter to the amnesia of the state.
So let me now turn to another key theme of the book, which is the interconnection that you draw between ethics and hospitality. And you do so through this concept that you explore and develop of Gharib Nawazi. So I was wondering if you could explain to our listeners what this concept is. And as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that, you know, ethical self-fashioning is one of the key themes of this book. So I was wondering if you could talk about how this concept of hospitality or Gharib Nawazi connect to the conception of the ethical that you developed that also depends on this kind of hospitality that people show to strangers at Firoz Shah Kotla.
Okay, so what's interesting, I was increasingly struck by Firoz Shah Kotla as I spent time there, and I kind of lead with a very interesting anecdote about, you know, when I realized this, when I realized that, no one actually uses names at Firoz Shah Kotla, names in the sense of using proper names or full names. And that was interesting to me because at this point of being several months in Firoz Shah Kotla, I'd had very deep and intimate conversations with people, and people had very deep and intimate conversations with me. And I knew a lot about them, but names and, you know, all the miseries and travails of their lives. But names were really not discussed often, or if people use nicknames or people use regional epithets, you know, that this person comes from this part of the city or this part of the city. But they don't use names. And I started wondering about what that was, right? Why is it that this is the way in which people interact with each other at dargahs? Why are people so intimate without using names? Why is there this culture of nameless intimacy within the space? And then I started thinking the way which, not just Firoz Shah Kotla, but perhaps other dargahs work as well. While I was at Firoz Shah Kotla, a lot of people would mention also going to Ajmer, ke hum Gharib Nawaz ki dargah ja rahe. We're going to the dargah of Muinuddin Chishti in Ajmer, whose epithet is Gharib Nawaz, right? One who's hospitable to the poor, but also in the sense of being hospitable to strangers. And I kept thinking about that term, Gharib Nawaz. I never really thought of it before, but given that there wasn't a culture of taking names at Firoz Shah Kotla, I wondered what it means to, whether there was a connection there, right? A conceptual connection between the idea of Gharib Nawazi and what is this kind of space that a dargah is that is different from other religious spaces, right? Why is it that people come here as opposed to going to a mosque or going to a temple or going to a church? And I found that actually was interesting, right? Why is it that only within the dargah is it that names kind of become immaterial? Names in India are, in South Asia in general, are very, very loaded, right? Like a name tells a lot about you, right? Just a first name, for example. Our first names convey a lot of information about us, about our social identities. You know, for example, which religion you've been brought up in, very, very easily. And so there is a way in which names overdetermine social identities, particularly in South Asia. And I think it's actually kind of radical to have a space where that social overdetermination disappears. And I was also paying a lot of attention to the ways in which, because, you know, Firoz Shah Kotla is a place where people come back, people who start coming here I became friends with people who'd been coming back for years, and the reason they kept coming back was because they said ki hame yahan pe aake matlab hamari zindagi badli hai, things have, our lives have become better, we've been healed, our lives have changed. So I was also paying attention to and thinking about the narratives of what that healing looked like and the narratives of what that change looked like in people's lives, whether it was the stories they were telling me or whether what the wishes that were being expressed in the letters that were the petitions that people submitted. And almost all of those stories are about transforming your given social identity, right? Like your place in the world that is determined by birth, right? The family you're born into, the caste you're born into, the religion you're born into. What I think was very interesting about Firosha Kotla is that it is a space where when you come in there, because your name and identity is disparate, it becomes a place where your social identity is suspended. So people become friends with each other, deep friends, and know each other's intimate life stories and, you know, all the travails and troubles before you know what their caste is, before you know what their religion is. Or even if you have some idea about it, that is not at the front of, you know, how you interact with the other person. So that I thought was why this hospitality that was kind of ingrained in the way that people interacted with each other in the site, right? The being hospitable to strangers, that because of nameless intimacy, you are all effectively strangers from each other, that allowed people to be estranged from their given social identity. And that is what actually allows for the possibility of ethical transformation, of becoming something other than you are, in a given social order. So
the next question I want to ask is about another major theme of this book, which is that it shows how spaces like Firosha Kotla or dargahs more broadly serve as spaces that also interrupt hardline communal or interreligious religious identities and boundaries and so on, and where religious identities are much more fluid than what one might expect from a communal standpoint. So I was wondering if you could share a bit about some moments of especially Hindu-Muslim encounters that you witnessed at Firosha Kotla in your ethnography that interrupted these kinds of communal and nationalist boundaries of religious identity.
Yeah, thank you. So one of the things that was, again, I think because of the ethic of nameless intimacy and of this kind of hospitality to strangers, what was very, very clear was that the long-standing friendships that I saw at Firosha Kotla were really not determined by questions of religious identity, by Hindu or Muslim, or caste identity, right? So one of the people who was, I talk about a lot in the book, and who's one of the most respected people among the people I sat with at Firosha Kotla is, for example, is Dalit, right? And I didn't, again, because of the ethics of nameless hospitality, no one ever talked about it. I mean, there would be like coded references to it, ki falaki kaum, etc., etc., but never explicitly. It was he told me himself, right, several months into, my research. And there were others, right? So the kinds of interactions I saw between the comfort between working class Hindus and Muslims, and again, across the boundaries of gender and caste are quite interesting, right? People had these very, very deep connections, which you wouldn't expect from what you read about, you know, the polarization between communities in India. And let's not forget that Delhi has been a scene of extreme communal violence, not just in 1947, but, you know, afterwards, the 1980s being particularly bad. So that was one aspect, that there were really these genuinely deep friendships. The other aspect of Hindu-Muslim interaction at Firosha Kotla is actually, in gender, there are a lot more women come here than men. And there is a very, very clear play of desire, right? In the sense of if you read the petitions that are written at Firoz Shah Kotla, it is often men and women petitioning the saint to help them get married to someone who their family or their community would disapprove of, including things that you can tell from the names that are written in the petitions, make it very clear that what is being asked for is in what we would call an inter-religious relation, right, which is completely disruptive of the morality of family and community. So I became really interested in why it is that the dargah becomes the space, right, the Muslim space becomes the space where those kinds of wishes can be articulated, the desire to marry someone from another caste or community. And it is really interesting to see how the saint is imagined. And I think women are kind of crucial to this in the sense that the saint is imagined at Firoz Shah Kotla, or the saints at Firoz Shah Kotla are imagined as the fathers of daughters, right? So Firoz Shah Kotla is a place where men often came, and this is to ask for girl children. Now, this again runs contrary to ideas we have about Delhi and patriarchy and a patriarchal society where, you know, we know that Delhi is a city with a skewed sex ratio of about 800 women to 1,000 men, partly because of, partly because there's a massive labor in migration, which is largely male, but also partly because of the selective abortion of female fetuses. So there is a way in which already this place is challenging what our ideas of patriarchal society are. So why is it that the Muslim saint becomes the father of daughters? Why is it that both men and women come here to in ways that are connected to women, right? In ways that are connected to if you talk to the men, they're like, yeah, either they started coming here to pray for daughters, or they started coming here because their wives were coming here, or, their wives used to come here, and then when their wives passed away, they started to come there. So there are all these ways in which every story about coming to Firoz Shah Kotla is somehow connected to women, whether it's men or women. And when you talk to women about the way they have these relations of intimacy with the saints, it's always like this relation of a father to a daughter. So here you have, and these are relations that are talked about by both Hindus and Muslims, right? So there is a kind of cross-religious community relation of kinship where for Hindu and Muslim women, the figure of the saint is the figure of the father of the girl child, which is a very interesting figure in North India, right, where kinship is patriarchal as it is in many other places, but familial arrangements are patrilocal, right, that women marry into the house of the in-laws, right, so they live with the family of the husband. So the father of the daughter is the one who is the kind of the anti-patriarchal father because he's the one who gives away his daughter. He's not the one who's going to carry forward whose lineage is going to be carried forward. So he has no investment in the patriarchal, in the continuation of the lineage. But he also, the father of the daughter, becomes the figure of innocence and intimacy and the childhood left behind. And that is for the congregation that comes here. Why do Muslim saints play that role in the ethical lives of the Hindu and Muslim men and women who come here? Why is it that, this is the place, the Muslim saint shrine, where you can express desires that you would be uncomfortable about expressing anywhere else? And I think, so what I do in the book is try to draw a genealogy, literally in the sense of like looking at how figures like jinns have been used even in the pre-modern past to to what do I want to say? Yeah, to work out issues of human intimacy. And I think there is we have to look at the affective heritage, right? The way in which the relationship of the Prophet Muhammad to his daughter, for example, right? The Prophet himself is a figure who is not a patriarchal figure, right? He's not the father of the community, in a sense. But his the primary relationship of him as a father is connected to his daughter, Fatima. And what is the affective inheritance of that that carries through and which carries through the memories of Muslim saints and even if they are jinn saints into contemporary life, I think really challenges ideas we have about how religions interact with each other. This kind of possibility of alternate kinship that it opens up for both Hindus and Muslims is very, very interesting.
So as a final substantive question, Anand, I want us to sort of take a step back and think more broadly about the larger intervention and the political stakes of this project. And I want to do that by having you talk about this very interesting, site that you talk about towards the end of your book, and very evocatively, especially in the conclusion or the epilogue, the Satpula. And I'll have you describe what it is, if you could share with our listeners its history and its present. And through that example, if you could tell us a bit about, you know, the larger sort of intervention and politics of this project. And, you know, as we were talking earlier, that in some ways this is a very tragic text, and it's talking about a tragic sort of a present in which nationalist and, you know, the post-colonial state has sort of taken over in terms of how identities are imagined. But then there are, in this mountains of darkness and tragedy, there is also avenues of hope that you also explore. So there is a note of optimism also that layers this book. So anyway, so I was wondering if you could speak a bit about these broader stakes by looking at this very specific example of the Satpula, as you talk about in your conclusion of the book.
Thank you. So the Satpula is a 14th century bridge and dam structure. It's kind of a dam with sluice gates and arches, and it's kind of a beautiful beautifully engineered structure in southern Delhi, which used to connect the flow of water into the 14th century city of Jahanpana, again a Tughlaq city, and at the time of the mass conurbation. So it's, you know, connected in terms of its historical era and in terms of its you know, architecture to Firozshah Kotla. It's a contemporary of this building. Now, Satpula, for the longest time, was actually a sacred space in the in the city. We have an 18th century description of a fair that happened around it, in which in front of the Satpula, you know, on the other side of the sluice gates, which there was a well, right? So obviously, where and there was water would collect there. There was a spring, and people would come and bathe in the spring because it was considered to have healing powers. So this medieval engineered structure and the kind of the natural feature that it was interacting with both kind of get sacralized and connected to the memory of the saint Nasruddin Chiraghi Veli, again 14th century. Chishti saint, who lived very close to the, whose khanka was very close to the Satpula. So anyway, so it's a major, if you read 18th century and Persian texts and 19th century Urdu texts, like for example, Syed Ahmad Khan's Asar al-Sanadin, this is a major sacred site in the city. So what I do in the book is talk about what the site used to be, where if you look at what it was like in the 18th century, you look at it in the 19th century, and then I describe my own visit to the site. And it's kind of a bleak picture, right? Because the site is now completely abandoned. The all the gaiety and the festiveness that was around the site, which is described in all these accounts, is gone. The stream that used to flow through the Satpula has been diverted. It flows about 50 meters to the west. Now, and it is no longer a site of, it's no longer a sacred site. It is no longer a tirth. Basically, the stream has become an open sewer because all the sewage of the developments that have come up further upstream are now going into the stream without being filtered in any way. So it's literally liquid shit and effluents that are in this formerly sacred stream. And of course, the groundwater is depleted, so whatever spring used to be there isn't there anymore. So for me, Satpula becomes kind of important because it is a great, here you can see how progressively not only has the post-colonial state disconnected the pre-colonial, the buildings of the pre-colonial past from their context and forgotten what they were about, but there is also an enormous ecological devastation that has come to the city, which has completely changed the way that, say, the phenomenological engagement with the sacred that used to be part of the city. You know, all of the, if you read 18th century accounts of sacred sites in the Delhi, the sacredness is almost always connected experientially to greenery, to flowing water, to the scent of flowers. It's a very ecological kind of experience of the sacred, even if you're talking about the Barkat of Saints tombs, right? So the Barkat of Qutbuddin Bakhtiar Kaki is connected directly to the, you know, the greenery of the surrounding trees of Mehrauli. All of these things, you just do not see any or experience that anymore. And Satpula becomes kind of emblematic of the ways in which there's been both a forgetting and a destruction of the sacred landscapes of Delhi. And I talk about it, Satpula, at the end of the book as well, because I contrast it to what I saw in Isfahan, right, where I visited while I was doing, I went to Iran on a short break while I was doing fieldwork in Delhi on the book. And there I saw a structure that, you know, architecturally was very much like the Satpula. This is the Pule Khaju in Isfahan. But except, but rather than being a dark, abandoned ruin, the Pule Khaju, which is 15th, 16th century, is actually an enormous center of social life in Isfahan, right? The river Zayandeh still flows through the arches there, through under the bridge, and you know, the sluice gates are open to let the river flow, and the water is clean, and people are dipping their feet into the water, and people, you know, use the arches under the bridge to sing, right? So they're singing hafiz, and the acoustics are marvelous, and the whole place is just alive. And so I, in the conclusion of the book, I talk about how it was going to Isfahan which made me realize what the life of the Satpula used to be like. That before that, I couldn't even imagine what this site was like. And so that is the despair in the book, right? That in some senses, to write about the ways in which the past is contested in Delhi, the medieval past and the material remains of the past is contested, is to tell a very sad story. It is to tell a story of enormous destruction and of enormous amnesia, which has kind of left these buildings contextless and left, you know, the urban development of Delhi has actually done an enormous amount of damage to, you know, the ecology of the city and the ways in which it was connected to the city's sacred geography. But at the same time, in Firoz Shah Kotla, you see where actually, bizarrely enough, because it is protected by the ASI, there hasn't been that development, right? So you still have a sense of the openness and the greenery of what earlier, of what an earlier sacred Dargah in Delhi might have looked like. You kind of have that at Firoz Shah Kotla, and the ways in which people here interact with birds and animals, the ways in which, not just the ways in which Hindus and Muslims interact with each other, men and women interact with each other, but the ways in which the humans of the city interact with the non-human animals at Feroz Shah Kotla also tells us that there is this kind of possibilities of hope and of reimagination of and of re-inhabiting the city. Now, Feroz Shah Kotla, I mean, jinns are shapeshifters in Islamic cosmology, so you know they can take the forms of animals, and that is how they can make themselves visible to you. So all interactions with animals at Feroz Shah Kotla, because it is a site of you know, of saintly jinns, all interactions with animals at Feroz Shah Kotla are potentially saintly, and so that makes interactions with all kinds of creatures at Feroz Shah Kotla very different from what one would imagine in a city that is, to paraphrase Nietzsche, all too human. And that is kind of the way in which I can see hope for a, you know, a different kind of imagination of living with the ecology, living with non-human others, that I see Feroz Shah Kotla opening up.
So Anand, as we are coming to the end of our time, could you share with our listeners what's the next project?
Yeah, so I've been in Delhi for the past 8 months. I'm working on a project on trying to understand Muslim ethics in the age of Hindutva. It's a little grandiose, but it's been a really interesting experience. And there are many, many things to talk about. But one of the aspects that that I'm having the most fun with, which I hope to write about the soonest, is looking at the emergence of Urdu poetry, the re-emergence of Urdu poetry in Delhi. It is a really interesting and productive time for Urdu poetry in Delhi right now. And bizarrely enough, it's been happening in the last 4 years, since we've had a particularly Islamophobic and majoritarian government in power. And I'm really interested in the forms of, not just in, you know, purely political poetry. Of course, that's there too, and it's really interesting. Some of the most interesting critiques of the current government have actually been articulated in Urdu poetry as opposed to any other form of literature. I'm also, beyond that, I'm really interested in what is the kind of imagination of the self and imaginations of relating to the other, imaginations of sovereignty that are being articulated, imaginations of romance that are being articulated through this poetry at this particular moment, how it's different from, you know, earlier Urdu poetry, how it connects, you know. So I spend a lot of time hanging out with poets. It's a lot of fun.
So, Genealogy, published by Stanford University Press, written by Anand Vivek Taneja. Thank you so much, Anand, for this conversation, for this wonderful book, and this multi-layered project. I look forward to the conversations that it will generate in multiple fields. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you.
So this was my conversation with Professor Anand Taneja about his wonderful new book, Genealogy. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Please also join us next time for another fresh episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, which operates online through the New Books Network. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Bye-bye now.